Welcome back to Discourse, the weekly occult and esoteric podcast hosted by myself, Abimon the Great, and Dr. Anna Stone. This week we are discussing the Sefer Yetzirah and how this important work of Kabbalism introduces profound insights onto the utilization of magical alphabets. So breathe in, young magus, and let the work begin. Okay, welcome back to Discourse with myself, Abimon the Great, and I am joined, as always, by the lovely Dr. Anna Stone.
Hello.
So
today we're going to be diving into one of the most mystical and foundational texts in mystic Judaism, which is the Sefer Yetzirah, right? And if you are unfamiliar, or maybe you've heard a little whispers here and there about it through Kabbalah or ceremonial magic, Abimon here is going to take us through it in a way that's deep but still accessible for anyone that's not familiar, like myself. I am not very familiar with this text, and so that's what we're going to be discussing today. You're going to share your wisdom on it, because I know you know that book pretty well.
Yeah, so the Sefer Yetzirah is probably my favorite piece of Kabbalah. It's rather short, so I think it's pretty accessible, but when we learn Kabbalah as magicians, or let's say, like metaphysical Kabbalah, which is like popular in like New Age, you know, that when we learn that nobody really approaches it. So they're more concerned with, Lurianic Kabbalah, which is heavily based around the Zohar and the Tree of Life, which is that structure that everybody associates Kabbalah with. So the Sefer Yetzirah, though, is probably, I mean, your big three Kabbalah texts, you know, like basically your five books of Moses are going to be the Sefer Yetzirah, the Behir, and the Zohar. And the Zohar is probably the most famous one.
Right. Is that a more narrative text than this one?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it's a mishmash of a lot of stuff. So you're going to see a lot of it. The Zohar explains like what certain verses mean, what certain things in the Talmud are. And then there's a lot of, you know, bonus lore in it, too. So there are narrative stories in it. Right. And the Zohar is a massive piece. Right. So if you are not Jewish, it's really difficult to approach it, especially if you don't know Hebrew. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's definitely a barrier to entry, right? Yeah. So let's just start at the beginning here. So for people that are not familiar, what is the Sefer Yetzirah, and why is it such a foundational and important text in mystical traditions?
So the Sefer Yetzirah is, as far as Kabbalah goes, it's probably the oldest piece of Kabbalah that we have on the literary record. So historically, Kabbalah does not become a thing until Spain in the Middle Ages, right? The Spanish Kabbalists. And it's around the time of the publication of the Zohar. It's like right before then is when Kabbalah actually starts becoming a theme. That's on the historical record. Now, if you ask Jews, they will say that it goes all the way down to the biblical patriarchs, and it was an oral tradition before then. So, right. you know, depending on what you want to say, but we can say that most of the concepts that are really important to Kabbalah appear in the Sefer Yetzirah. And the Sefer Yetzirah, Jews will claim it either came from Adam or Abraham or Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva was a very famous rabbi in the first century. And like in the Talmud, there's a lot of stories about him. He's very much like a legendary figure, but he actually was a real figure too. So they will attribute. So I guess you could compare Rabbi Akiva to Judaism's equivalent of Saint Peter.
Okay.
He's basically at the foundation of the rabbinic tradition in Judaism.
Right.
There's sects of Judaism that will attribute the Sefer Yetzirah to him and his school too.
Okay. So yeah. Let's just address the elephant in the room here. You are not Jewish.
No,
so
I'm not.
Why did you get interested? How did you get interested in it? And what was your first experience with it?
Well, I guess as a magician, we get exposed to Hermetic Kabbalah pretty early on, especially through the tarot. So it's like true. In ceremonial magic or modern Hermeticism, you know, you see the Hebrew letters on all the cards and you hear about the Sephirot all the time,
right.
You know, a large part of modern ceremonial practice is approaching the Sephirot as a kind of visual roadmap to where you should be in your spiritual growth.
Right.
Like it's basically a check mark of, you know, oh, I went into this Sephirot and I learned this. And you do path working, which is moving the lines between the Sephirot on the Tree of Life. However, I got disillusioned with it pretty quickly in my early occult career, as it seemed like it was just a roadmap or a table of correspondences to me, at least the way that magicians were teaching it. And so I wanted to like look into what the Jews had to say about it,
right.
You know, because I knew that this was what magicians were saying about the Kabbalah. And the first book that I approached was the Sefer Yetzirah, because I looked at the Zohar and I was like, this is way too big.
Yeah, too much. Like, right.
Yeah.
So as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that this text is about the creation of life through the 22 letters of the alphabet? Somehow?
Yeah. So I would say it's expanded fan fiction on the very first chapter of Genesis.
Okay.
Right. It's about how God created the universe, you know? Okay,
yeah. And to that point, great, that was my next question, actually.
Yeah.
So most of us are familiar with the story of creation from the book of Genesis,
yes.
Right? Even if we're not religious, we've heard it at some point in our life, where like in 7 days, right? Like God creates all the living things in the earth and everything,
yes.
In the universe. How does this process differ as it's written in this text compared to in the book of Genesis?
I don't think it does. So I think that really the Sefer Yetzirah, it's not that big of a book. There's a short version and a long version. I have my Sefer Yetzirah right here.
Yeah, that's
this short. One seems pretty big, but the actual text itself is short. This is a commentary. So it goes line by line. It breaks down what each line means.
Okay.
And that's how a lot of people approach the Sefer Yetzirah. But I would say if you took that verse from Genesis where God spoke the universe and creation, the entire Sefer Yetzirah is about how he spoke it.
Right. Because the book of Genesis is more of a story, right? Like a narrative story.
Yes. Yeah.
And this one is more of a symbolism of how it was created as math and linguistics, right? Like through math and linguistics.
Yeah, so it's it definitely reads like Genesis. It's in that same style, where it's like broken down into stanzas. It feels like it belongs in the book of Genesis. But scholars place the Sefer Yetzirah around the second century all the way up until the 6th century AD,
right.
Because there are certain writing styles in it that can place it in that
time period.
So it's like if you were to read it like as not a scholar, you might think it was written at the same time as Genesis, but scholars can see some deviations in it.
Right. So you mentioned that you were introduced to it via ceremonial magic or magicians that were talking about the Sephirot, right?
Yeah.
Which, again, a lot of people have heard of, even if they're not Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
But what are, for those that aren't, because I know it's not everybody. I was just introduced to that when I took that class on Kabbalah for my master's in consciousness studies. So I had no idea about, I mean, I did know, but I didn't know I knew. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like beforehand. So this is like the Tree of Life thing, right? You know, so what are the Sephirot and how do they appear in this text? And are they the same or different from the Tree of Life that we hear about in later Kabbalah?
So the Sephirot are emanations of God, and the Sefer Yetzirah says that they are emanations of nothingness, right?
Okay.
That the Sefer Yetzirah claims that there are only 10 of them, not right. 9 and not 11. So
that's right.
The secret hidden 11th one does not fit within a Yetzirahic understanding of Kabbalah. Okay. The Sefer Yetzirah also claims that these Sefirot are dynamic and not static. So trying to place them on a tree as a roadmap in a hierarchy doesn't really work from a Yetzirahic understanding. Right.
That yeah. I did learn also. Yeah. I did learn about that because it's like you might be backtracking in one and still going toward forward in another, right? Mm-hmm. Like yeah. when you're doing path working or something, yeah. Which is later. That's a later concept, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there is, yeah, that's right. There's 10, not 11 or 9. So that's the original. Yeah. They all stem from this, right? This is what you... Is that your understanding?
Yeah, so this on the literary record, the first time you see the Sefirot mentioned, written down, is in this book, right? And so in the Zohar is the foundation of, you know, how people started constructing trees, right?
Okay.
And so that branch of Kabbalah where you're trying to create like a cosmological framework, which is probably the most important or the most popular branch of Kabbalah, that is known as Theosophical Kabbalah, and that's probably what 90% of Kabbalists are, right?
Okay.
There's few other branches. There's Meditative Kabbalah, which Sefer Yetzirah is amazing for, and then there's the Practical Magical Kabbalah, which Sefer Yetzirah is also amazing for.
Okay.
The Magical Kabbalah is under lock and key. It is ridiculously hard to get access to that even today.
What? Oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, now you have to look for it.
Yeah. But the Meditative Kabbalah, if you learn the Meditative Kabbalah and the Sefer Yetzirah, you can kind of figure it out because the recipes for magical Kabbalah it is in the Sefer Yetzirah.
Well, I feel like there's a lot of different corresponding concepts that come out of this book too.
Yeah.
Because there is... To my understanding, this book also talks about the three mothers, uh-huh. the seven doubles, and the 12 elementals, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the three mothers would sound to me like the mother, maiden, crone, or yeah. the trinity, mm-hmm. right? The seven doubles would be the seven traditional planets, right? Mm-hmm. Or classical planets.
Yeah.
And then the 12 elementals would be obviously the zodiac, right? I mean, yes. Are those... Is that right?
It actually directly relates. Maybe not the mother, maiden, crone.
Well, okay.
But it directly relates the planets in the zodiac to those groupings of the letters within the Sefer Yetzirah.
And then also with the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet, yeah. right? That's been tied many times to tarot, the major yes. arcana, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So what do the three mothers stand for in this book?
It's Aleph, Mem and Shin.
Yeah.
And those are supposed to be basically the foundation of what everything is based off of. So Aleph is basically a silent letter. It's used for vowel sounds, but it's supposed to represent breath. It's supposed to represent Ruach, which is the spirit, right? And I think it's...
Is that
I quote
air?
It all the time. Yeah. So it's the air principle. Sefer Yetzirah 3:4, chapter 3, verse 4. It's Aleph decides between Shin and Mem. And so Shin, that's the fire, right? Because it hisses like a fire. And then Mem is water. And it's, you know, like that. So basically what the Sefer Yetzirah states is that Shin is, you know, the divine fire. And then Mem is the water of which manifestation is made. And air is what pulls the two together and creates earth, basically, okay. manifestation.
Okay. Yeah. And then the seven doubles?
Yeah. So the doubles would be sounds in the Hebrew alphabet that have two ways you can say it. So like you could do B, like a hard B, or a V, that almost like a soft B that sounds like a V. Uh-huh. Same with like a G, it would be a G or G.
Yeah.
Like that. And so the doubles are then associated with the classical planets. And you can see that there are two, because there are two sounds to it, they represent a duality within each of those things, right? Okay. So it's like strong and weak. So depending on what you're trying to do, you would use either the, you know, strong sound or the weak, the soft sound.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. So, and then the 12 elementals are tied directly to the zodiac.
Yeah, they're tied to the zodiac. In I think it's in the 5th chapter of the Sefer Yetzirah. So, that's their entire alphabet, and it's broken down into these sections. And obviously, those are some pretty important numbers for magic and esotericism. Right. So you can see how that can really quickly become magical,
right?
If you understand where these things are placed.
So to that point, very, very good here. You're helping me move this along very nicely. How has this text influenced magical or esoteric traditions outside of the Jewish religion?
So I think I think understanding Kabbalah, even if you're not going to use or this particular brand of Kabbalah, even if you're not going to use Hebrew or do Jewish Kabbalah, is that it is probably the most extensive written work on letterism. And letterism is magical alphanumericism, right?
Okay.
So using the concepts that you find within the Sefer Yetzirah, you learn how to make alphabets magical and use them in magical contexts, right?
Okay.
So whether you're using runes, there's a really interesting book called The Greek Kabbalah by Kieran Berry, I think. And he basically takes the Hebrew letterism and puts it into the Greek alphabet and Pythagoreanism and plugs it in there. So if you had a Greek or Hellenic practice, understanding the letterism in the Kabbalah is how you would be able to apply that to, the Greek. And then it held a huge influence on Arabic letterism, right?
Okay, yeah.
So this kind of like magical alphanumericism and Arabic magic is really, really dependent on letterism. It's one of the biggest factors of it. And so really, the Sefer Yetzirah, the reason that it's good to study these things as a magician and to learn about this as a magician is because it's breaking down, it's giving you magic words, right? It's teaching you how to use those magic words and how to use language magically. Because what it's doing is it's expanding on how God created the universe, how he spoke it into creation. And if we as magicians are engaging in a creative process where we are manifesting things,
right,
this is telling us exactly how to emulate that action.
So that makes sense to me, because that is traditionally what all I've used for magic is words,
yeah,
just speaking it, mm-hmm, and it is then so, right? Mm-hmm. So that would make sense to me why or how that works, because if you say it a certain way, it seems to work.
Yes.
You know, I can't really tell you what that way is because I'm not sure exactly what I do when that happens, but
yeah,
it's some kind of, definitely I know what you mean by that. Like, that makes perfect sense to me. This is also heavily, there's a heavy emphasis rather placed on this structure of, or this text rather, within the Hermetic Kabbalah, the Golden Dawn, and just occultism in general, right?
Yeah, so I think that's where it deviates the most, is once we go look at the Hermetic Kabbalah, which would be your Kabbalah with a Q, and New Age practices also use Hermetic Kabbalah as well. Right. So that is, that's where the Sefer Yetzirah and the Jewish literature, it deviates a lot. For example, one of the things that we as magicians associate, you know, Mars is Tuesday, you know, and you're going to use Mars for violence or curses or, say, if you're an athlete, like that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
So you use Mars for that on a Tuesday, right? And the Sefer Yetzirah, so this would be coming from Hermetic Kabbalah, the Sefer Yetzirah in Jewish Kabbalah says that Mars is on Monday and you use him for wealth, right? What? Yeah, exactly.
That doesn't even make sense.
That's what's in the book, right? And so you're unlocking some of these, like, how does that not make sense, though?
Wait, what do you mean? Like, so if you're using, because it's a duality, is that what you mean? Or like,
Well, Mars is
Mars is always
is
about
a,
war and
think about him as Alexander the Great, the emperor.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that makes
How
sense.
How does the emperor get his wealth? By conquering everything.
Okay. Yeah, I guess. Yeah, see? I wouldn't have made that correspondence.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I know that there's a lot of talk about this book not being meant to be understood by intellect alone.
It's
not. What does
that
mean?
So that's one of the things that I think in my Kabbalistic practice where I deviate from most Kabbalists. And what frustrates me is why I have a hard time talking to other Kabbalists is because Kabbalah in my life and in my practice is not a intellectual organization or a theology or a cosmological structure. It is a living, breathing thing that I do. And that's the meditative Kabbalah, right?
Okay.
So the meditative Kabbalah, and as outlined in the Sefer Yetzirah, and within the practice of meditative Kabbalah, is you're using these letters, you're visualizing them, you're drawing them like doing calligraphy, and then you're placing them on different parts of your body. You're breathing them in, breathing them out, and then you're changing them. You're morphing them with visualization, by reciting them. And they're long strings of letters, right? It looks
right.
Like a printer test
yeah,
when you're doing
that.
It.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. So that is, you know, when you talk Kabbalah to most Kabbalists, they're not going to talk so much about that as they're going to talk about, you know, approaching certain sephirot or, you know, breaking the divine spark out of a klipa or that kind of thing. My practice of Kabbalah and people that follow this brand of Kabbalah, they're more concentrated on using that alphabet, and they understand the alphabet as a kind of this matrix of spatial dimension.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. I mean, yeah, so it's dynamic. It's like you said.
Yeah.
So if somebody wanted to start working with the ideas within this text, either spiritually or magically, right?
Yeah.
What would that actually look like?
Yeah, so I think, so this one right here, specifically, this is my favorite one. This is a commentary by Aryeh Kaplan.
Uh-huh.
He is a rabbi from the 1980s that was like really intent on opening meditative Kabbalah up to Gentiles and just, you know, regular Jews that weren't, you know, so esoterically inclined. And so you can find he's got a lot of practical meditations. Like he'll go through a verse and then he'll give you a practical meditation. It's like, okay, do this in order to explore like what we were talking about right here. So I think one of the very first ones that he does is it's a Mem Shin permutation.
Okay.
And the Mem Shin permutation is thought to be the permutation that Elijah, the biblical patriarch, was doing in order to get his prophecies.
Okay.
So
can you just define permutation?
Yeah.
For those people that are not aware.
So a permutation is basically where you're transforming the letter using vowel sounds, right?
Okay.
So you start with let's say a mem, which is their M sound, and then you draw the M with your mind's eye, and then you morph it because every single letter has similar components to it. You morph it into a shin, right?
Okay.
So that would be their S sound. And as you're morphing it, their sh sound, so not the S. So you're morphing it into another letter, and as you're doing that, you're using the Aleph, which is that empty space in between, uh-huh, in order to go through the vowel sound and change the letter.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, like, of all of the things that you've heard about this, you said you had a hard time talking to other Kabbalists, but when you have, or just talk to anybody else that has read this or knows something about it, what do you think the biggest misconception about it is?
About the Sefer Yetzirah?
Yeah.
I think most people understand what it is, especially when you reach it. I think really the deviation lies within the motivation of the person that's looking into it. Okay. So, like I said, what I deem important and useful in Kabbalah and essential to my practice of Kabbalah is not what somebody who is focused on cosmologically ordering the Sephiroth or, you know, bringing down the Ein Sof or breaking the, we're interested in completely different things, right?
Right.
And so how I understand the Kabbalah is not going to be exactly in line with how somebody that was focused on the tree and the paths would be understanding it.
Okay, right. So, and then, do you think that, okay, let me think how to ask this. So as you've gone through this, you know, path of spirituality and magic, mm-hmm. right? When you first were introduced to this,
mm-hmm.
do you feel that your understanding of it has changed as your spiritual journey has progressed?
I wouldn't say there's been much like, you know, having to reformat my understanding of it, but it is one of those, like, it's very short text, but it's one of those things. I've been practicing the Sefer Yetzirah as an essential meditative practice. Whenever I meditate, I'm doing Yetziratic meditations for nearly 10 years now. And it's, I never stop unlocking stuff with it.
Right.
Never stop learning from it.
So it's because I've, one of the things that a lot of the other references to this book have said is that it evolves as you evolve with your consciousness.
Yes.
Right.
I think this thing that I've been railing on about matrices or whatever is one of my most recent developments with it. Just like a three-dimensional cube with these letters like placed all over it, and I'm connecting to each one when I'm using it.
That's funny. I've definitely heard that, and actually I have like two comments to make about what you've said. First is I have also done those meditative sessions in class. My rabbi that taught the class would have us read a verse or a section from it, and then we'd have to meditate on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what you're talking about, right? Like that's what he would have us do the beginning of every class and the end of every class.
Well,
so
it's
you're supposed to visualize something in our head. You would give us instructions.
Yeah, the letters. And so the letters are supposed to be visualized as black flame, like made of black flame on a white background. And then you're changing the letters.
Did not tell me that part.
Yeah.
But that's how I saw it. Okay, interesting. Okay, cool. Yeah. So good to know. It's crazy. Also, second here is, so this is not going to work for somebody that can't see things in their mind's eye.
Dependent. I'd say, and I really don't think so. I think that it would work, right?
Wow. If you can't visualize in your mind's eye something.
It doesn't need to be as vivid as a dream, right? As long as there's the focus and the concentration on drawing it, you know, you don't have to like visually see it.
Oh, okay. So yeah, because there's people that can't do that, you know, it's like 50% of the population can't visualize things.
I don't believe in magic. I don't believe in the word can't.
I don't either, but they say they can't.
I
don't know if maybe they're just confused.
I don't know what the what,
like. I don't understand.
That is not can't should not be a part of the magician's lexicon at all.
True.
You believe in magic.
Yeah.
Is not supposed to exist.
Right.
So
right.
It's like if you believe in magic and you're saying can't.
Right.
Like you're not like what are you doing?
I don't know. I just know that there's people that say they can't do that. You know.
Yeah.
And I don't know what they mean
by
that.
I think it's a cop out. To be honest.
I honestly just have no clue what that means. That just does not resonate in any way, shape, or form with me, and I feel like they're confused and they don't know what they mean. Maybe they're thinking it should be as vivid as real life or something.
Everybody has different experiences and capacities, right? So it's like some people have prophantasia where they can like literally like create with waking eyes and image in front of them,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so, is that what that's called?
Yeah,
I can literally.
Some people
do that.
Have that. Yeah. Most people don't, you know. But that doesn't mean that you can't visualize things, or you can't like.
Yeah, I don't understand.
Just... And especially like if you want that, you know.
Yeah.
Do some magic about it.
Yeah. True, because that's just, I mean, so I'm thinking to myself, so there's no way that these people, like, if you recall a memory, you can't do that? Like,
yeah.
Something, you know, like, that's not a thing? I have a hard time with understanding this, if that's really a thing that is true. Like, people really cannot do this. But I'm just saying, if that is something that is required, then this could be difficult. How about not impossible, but difficult for somebody that doesn't feel they have the ability to create an image.
I think it would be difficult and frustrating the same way that meditation is difficult and frustrating when you first start doing
it. Oh my gosh.
You know, like, am I doing it wrong? Am I doing like that kind of stuff? And then you get to a point where it's like, it doesn't matter.
If it's wrong, there's no wrong or right.
Sitting down and doing it, that's what matters.
Right. You know? Or not sitting down. Like, sometimes some of us have to meditate doing things, because that's just how it is. So, but that's one of the things. I had a classmate in the class with me who said that they had aphantasia aneurysm. They couldn't see in their mind's eye and they couldn't visualize things. So they couldn't do these tasks that, you know, these meditations that he would have us do. And he just was like, okay, you know, but so they said they dropped the class because they didn't think they could get anything out of it. That's why I'm wondering, because as you're saying how you have to visualize it, I'm like, reminded me of her.
Yeah.
But maybe that's the trick. If you have to keep trying, you know, maybe you got to keep trying at that.
Yeah. You have to stop looking for a result or a white light experience and you have to just be there doing it.
Right. Yeah. Because that's very rare that that's going to happen anyway. Yeah. Right. So if you had to pick one lesson or one little nugget of wisdom that you have picked up from the Sefer Yetzirah that you think people in this world today really need, what would that be?
Oh, that's a really tough question.
Sorry.
That's crazy.
Why?
I don't know. I don't know how to... one lesson?
Yeah, like one bit of wisdom that might help people today.
Oh, yeah. So it's funny. I'm going to say this as somebody that, you know, cusses like a sailor or whatever, but language and words, they have magical effect.
They do.
Really powerful.
Oh, this is where I have, this is difficult because they do, right? But at the same time, a lot of people are very upset over lots of words and focus, hyper-focus on things.
Yeah.
Labels or slurs or cuss words, whatever. And it's, to me, I just think, you know, like, why? It's just words. Yeah. But that being said, words do have power, right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of, for me, it's that, oh, I don't know how to navigate that really. Because I do believe words have power. But at the same time, I think sometimes there's words that people get all their panties in a twist about and they should just ignore it, you know, like let it, who cares?
Yeah.
You know, not get so upset.
So you speak your world into existence.
You do.
So
yes.
That's the thing. It's entirely personal. Right. So I just trying to monitor or avoid other people's words, that kind of thing, isn't really about you speaking your world into existence. It's about you. It's more like an emotional reaction.
Right. Right? Okay. That's a good point. And that's actually very true. That's not you saying anything. It's you hearing something that has a different, that's different.
Yeah.
But when you said, when I asked about like what would help people, and you mentioned this, the words have power, words have meaning, because we do speak our world into existence, right? So, are you saying then what that means is to like for people to remember that their negative comments about things are likely bringing those negative experiences towards them. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. If I mean, to get into the very like, you know, folksy, witchy side of things, you know, you're bad mouthing somebody, you're putting something out there and it's going to affect them. Right.
Right. I mean, yeah. So you put that energy out. Yes. Yeah. You're creating an energy that's focused on that person. Yeah. Right.
And it's more real than, like, this isn't, it's incredibly real.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just a, you know, kind of like idealistic golden rule kind of axiom, right? It's a, like, you, so the Sefer Yetzirah, it's talking about how God, he's basically carving, using the letters, he's carving the universe into creation. He engraves the letters, right? So if you think of that process of engraving, you know, it's making an impression, yes, right? And so
scarring the environment.
This is what we're doing through our process of, like, we are creating a delineation or a layer of separation. We're giving something form by cutting away from it, right?
Right. Yeah, okay. I mean, that makes perfect sense. And I'm, as somebody that has said things, mm-hmm. and immediately those things happen exactly in the same way. It is absolutely factual that it happens. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people, though, will dismiss that experience, right?
Yeah.
They might say something, and then it happens, and then they like, oh, that's a coincidence, right? That's the typical, you know, if you're not in the magical practice kind of environment, right?
Yeah.
That's not your thing and you're just going about your life and you say something and then that happens, typically negative, right? Like, I'm going to say it's very easy to conjure negativity towards you with your words.
Yeah.
But people will dismiss that as just being a coincidence, mm-hmm. right? And not understand that their own words are what's bringing those things to them. I do think that that's probably a very good lesson people should know, really. Mm-hmm. I wish that we taught that.
Well, it's just to be like a little more self-aware and intentional when we speak. And a part of the Kabbalistic meditation and permutation is paying attention to where the sounds are coming out of your mouth, like where you're placing them on your tongue, like on your teeth, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And that type of meditation, like when you're doing Kabbalistic permutation, you're visualizing it, and then you can also be vocalizing it, right? So if I'm going, focusing there, and that type of meditation, like if you're doing mindfulness meditation, you're paying attention to where your thoughts are coming from, right?
Right.
And then when you're doing Kabbalistic meditation, you're paying attention to where your words and your sounds are coming from.
Okay. Interesting. Like, so do you think that this, the Sefer Yetzirah was meant to be a practical manual for mystics?
I think so, 100%. I couldn't rationalize why it would be listing off every letter and what planet it was associated to and what body part it was if it wasn't trying to tell you to do something. And the grandest magical actions a Kabbalist can perform is the creation of a golem, right?
Oh, yeah,
and
that's
the,
it?
It comes from the Sefer Yetzirah, how to do it, right? So basically what you are doing when you're creating the golem is you are emulating the act of God creating Adam.
Okay.
Right?
Right.
So
you know, you're creating mm-hmm. something out of nothing other than sound vibrations.
Making a living thing. Right. You're ensouling the earth.
A part of the earth, right?
Part of the earth, like just as God did.
Is that the same as an egregore?
A golem?
Yeah.
I don't know. I've never met a golem. Step away from when we were digging through Abraham Abulafia, you know, it seems that his light being that he created or was creating or trying to get you to create with the alphabet, that seemed like a golem and that seemed like a metaphysical thing and not a physical thing. Right. However, the legends, Kabbalistic legends, that they're very physical things. Yeah.
Well, I'm wondering if they are actually physical or if they can just interact with the physical and create physical disturbance or change.
Like Full Metal Alchemist, you know? Like
Jesus Christ. Flashbacks.
I love that show so much. It's so great.
My oldest daughter.
I was obsessed with it in high school. Yeah.
Oh my God. I, all those books.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, yikes. Okay. Yeah. That was painful for me. Yeah. I didn't get it. But that's what that's about. Is that what that's about?
What?
That show? I don't even know.
Well, yeah. The, the, you know, suit of armor kid.
Yeah.
He's ensouled in the suit of armor.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So if you think about like a golem, you know, you're
like a doll, ensouling, haunted doll.
Ensouling clay or earth, right? Yeah.
So you could put it in a doll or creepy. Yeah. No, thanks. Okay. So it's supposed to be physical, but I mean, and that's the legend. That's the lore.
That's the lore. Yes.
Physical. Mm-hmm. They see this mud person coming around.
Maybe.
Hanging out. Okay. That's terrifying. That would not be fun for me.
I can't recall a time where it's like a mud person.
I mean, I don't know, earth
it's
person.
It's made from, yeah, it's like made from earth. The legends themselves, like the Golem of Prague, and like there's this really famous Kabbalistic legend where these Kabbalists try to make a goat for everybody to eat. Like you couldn't eat a goat golem if it was made from rocks, right?
I don't know.
It would have to be a flesh goat.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. But like, I mean, were they successful at that?
No, they got fused to the ground, like Full Metal Alchemist.
Oh,
yeah.
Or like the Manhattan Project.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
or creepy. The Philadelphia experiment.
One it is. Yeah,
Philadelphia experiment.
Yeah,
yeah.
Whichever weird one.
So they messed it up. They got fused to the ground, and then
That's
the rabbi had to come and do the permutation backwards.
Yeah.
Turn him back to normal or whatever.
Okay, so is creating a golem in this book?
Yes, it is in this one.
For what? What's the point? Why would you do that?
You're supposed to be using them only under the license with permission from God himself.
Okay.
And I think it's like for protection or for help or that kind of stuff.
But for under what circumstances does it say?
No, it doesn't say. Not in the Sefer Yetzirah, so... It doesn't say under what circumstances, but you do need to get permission from God in order to do it. So the Golem of Prague, I think it was getting the Jewish community there was getting invaded.
Okay.
And
so that's protection.
The Kabbalists got permission from God to create a golem to protect the Jewish community.
How did they obtain permission from God? Does it say?
No, it does not say. Oh, yeah. But
darn.
I I've told you about the breastplate or whatever. Yeah.
The
divining
yes and
plate.
No,
yeah, the yes and no.
What? Yeah, no. Yeah. Can you repeat that? Like, I would like. Yeah. So there's a divination tool
that they used to use in the original Jewish religion, which was very like when they're this is before the rabbinic tradition, right?
Okay. Yeah.
And they would the priest during court cases would wear a breastplate and had two stones on it. One of them was black and one of them was white. And, say somebody like robbed a store or killed somebody.
Yeah.
They get brought before the priest. The priest would wear the breastplate with the stones in it. And I don't know exactly how it works. I don't think anybody knows exactly how it works. But the stones would indicate like whether the person was guilty or not.
The stones
and that would be
on
like
the breastplate.
Voice. Yeah. It could be as easy as, like I Ching or something.
Yeah.
You just throw,
just
them,
throw
on the
them on the ground and see what is closest
like it's
to you or something.
For
I don't
sure.
know.
Like 100%.
Yeah, that sounds like very arbitrary there. Yeah. Like 50-50 chance, right? I hope there was a better system than that. Maybe they had something we don't know about. But that's interesting. So,
biblical Judea? I don't know.
I mean, who knows? Maybe, well, back then we
you
were getting
the
direct...
Old Testament. I mean, you
it's
know,
great. Yeah, it's
no
a little
offense,
harsh.
But you know, those
nuts.
Hebrews were pretty
brutal. Yeah, brutal. Yeah. I know you accidentally mix fabrics and you're like stoned to death or something. Yeah, it's not.
I mean, they slaughtered the entire Levant. You know.
No, what? Yeah. I didn't read. Like, I don't remember most of that. It was traumatic.
It came up from Mount Sinai and killed everybody in the Levant. And took it over.
That's not, I don't know if the Old Testament is like.
I love the Old Testament.
It's fun to read, but it's very difficult.
Brutal,
like it's very, like not very nice, you know. It's like everybody would be dead already if we were going by that kind of stuff. So are there any modern magical systems or practices that you think still carry the DNA of this text, even if they don't name it directly.
Okay, so ton of it.
Yeah.
Ton of it. So if we can look at this as like basically one of the masterpieces of letterism and as highly influential on letterism, I'd say that, you know, anytime you're using a magic square, you know, and by that extension, anytime you're using a sigil, where do the sigils come from? The sigils come from magic squares. Where do magic squares come from? Magic squares come from letterism, alphanumericism, okay, plugging them in, knowing which sequence to do the letters in order to conjure that spirit or entity or that kind of thing. Because each one of them is a string of letters. And what exactly is happening in that string of letters? You're touching on these. I like to think of the letters as like molecules or atoms within a molecule, right? And I think that's when you take a Yetzeratic approach to Kabbalah to understand the Sephirot and to understand the letters, that's what it starts to look like. The Sephirot start to look like the atoms in an element, right? Or like
a compound, like the molecules in
like
a compound.
The structure, yeah, like the structure of the element. And so every single thing, I mean, me and you have the same, you know, are made up of the same elements, but in different proportions, right?
Well, we're made up, every living thing is made up. Well, all living things are made, everything on Earth anyway.
Yeah.
99% the DNA is identical.
Yeah.
It's only 1% that accounts for our biological sex, our ethnicity, our height, our size. Like, I mean, every differentiating factor is 1%, which is, and that's every, that's from like a blue whale to a person. Like it's 99% the same. It's all made up of chumps, right? Like carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur. So everything is, which is crazy. Like it's just arranged different. That's right. Yeah. So if you look at, if you get a pharmaceutical drug and you take open the box and it has that big page that you fold open, you know, and it has a molecular structure, every single thing, like you could get another drug that's one like section different orientation and it's a whole different thing.
Yes.
It's so it's is all how it's placed. And
if you think about it, it's like the letter, the pictograph of the letter, the actual image of the letter, that is the spatial essence of it, right?
Okay.
Because an image is spatial. So that's a spatial essence. As you vocalize the letter, that you're vibrating something, and sound is a perception of time, right? So you have space and time right there that are in that. So by that extension, because there's this spatial quality to the letters, you're doing them in a certain sequence and you're vocalizing them, you know, by that extension, geometry is getting packed into it too. And that's what creates the 3D space. So right there, you're using math, space, time, geometry,
linguistics.
Right? Using language. So you're using the stuff of the universe, right? Of creation, and you're doing it in a certain sequential order to make things happen.
Okay. So are you, when you say spatial, you're meaning taking up space? Is that what you mean? Okay.
Yes.
So, so we do this all the time though. Like this is a pro. So I think this can be understood fairly easily with the idea of like the language, the words that are created every year that are added to the dictionary, right? Like our youth comes up with some interesting phrases, and it means a thing, right? Whereas before it didn't mean a thing and now it does. Yeah. They're creating something that's almost tangible.
Yeah.
Kind of. It's tangible that you could write it, right? You can actually write it out. And it creates a thing. So we're adding that. Language does create. It does, absolutely does. I think that's very easy to be, you know, to see in being demonstrated constantly as we go through life, right? There's new terms coming up all the time. And then suddenly it wasn't a thing, now it is, right? So that is, I mean, that's very commonplace example of how you create with language, right? So there's, I'm going to venture to guess, because in my experience with texts that are not in English and that are then translated into English, depending on who translates it, it's going to have different a different outcome for the translated version of a text, right?
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that this is no different and that there's probably a lot of different versions of it out there that
yeah.
are, and there are.
Yeah, yeah. There's two main different versions. There's the called the long version and the short version, and that's basically just talking about the length of it,
okay.
right? But even the long version isn't that long. It's okay. like,
well, what about the commentaries? Like,
so the commentaries is where that's where it deviates highly.
Okay,
you know, and so depending on what commentary you're studying and using is dependent on how you're going to apply what you're reading in there.
Right.
So I think it's like, I love the Arya Kaplan version, but you know, there are commentaries on the book that go back, you know, over 1,000 years, you know.
So you think worldview from the author of the translated commentary is going to play a part in how they decipher the
yes.
messages within the book?
Yeah. So I think one of the very interesting things about mystic Judaism is that there's always this kind of underlying physics underneath it. Like they're approaching it's kind of like when you study Vedic or like Hinduism, there's like some kind of like almost astronomy or cosmology that's happening in uh-huh. it. With Judaism, there's this essence of like physics underneath it. And so dependent on the person who's doing the commentary, just like how they're relating it in that time period based off of that time period's understanding of space-time and geometry, that's what's going to be related through the commentary. So one of the things about Arya Kaplan, right? So there's this theoretical mathematical matrix called a complex polytope.
Okay.
Right. And it's from theoretical mathematics and it's very, very recent. Right. Yeah. And so Arya Kaplan is specifically because he existed in a time when a complex polytope existed, the way that he maps out the arrays for creating the golem is on a complex polytope. And so he's able to, and that is like a kind of complex polytope is like a.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I was just going to say, what the hell is that?
It's like a hyperdimensional circle of vertices.
So it's right? like a tesseract, but a different form.
But it's like a circle. Yeah,
right. Okay.
It's like a circle and it's
okay.
like multidimensional, right?
Okay.
Yeah. Like it's four dimensional.
Okay.
So.
Yeah. Which is something four and five dimensional is hard for us to.
Yeah.
Kind of.
It's hard. Yeah. It's hard for us to visualize, especially difficult to draw. Right.
Right.
But so.
Huh.
Yeah. So it's like Arya Kaplan, he's trying to teach you, or he's trying to tell you, it's like, how do you map these arrays when you're in these arrays of permutations when you're in visualization trying to create a golem, right?
Yeah.
And he's showing you the vertices on a complex polytope where you're going to
oh
be
God.
Placing each
yeah.
letter.
Yeah. So, okay. So then I'm going to, then it, that would, it would make sense then that if somebody doesn't have an understanding of physics like that
mm-hmm.
at all, or
yeah.
complex polytopes, mm-hmm. which I just learned about,
yeah.
Their translation would be different. Their commentary
yeah.
would be different.
So like, for example, Abraham Abulafia is probably the most legendary Yetzeratic Kabbalist,
yeah.
right? He was of the same camp that I am. That's like, pay attention to the letters and,
yeah.
You know, this isn't, you know, you guys are building Towers of Babel with like trying to construct these trees and cosmologies. He's like, but what are you connecting to God through it? You know, like by rational, you're not going to rationalize your way to God, basically. So,
right. That makes sense.
But yeah, so Abraham Abulafia, like he is giving you arrays, and arrays are extremely appropriate for the time period that he existed in when Arabic mathematics were like the premier of mathematics. Right. So the way that he's teaching his Kabbalah, which is based on the Sefer Yetzirah, is through these array sets.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's crazy. That's so complicated. Especially, I think that we have a misconception about how advanced people were back in the day. I think that we think we're smart. and that because we have all this fancy technology, we're smarter than ancients, right? I think that's wrong. I think that they were far smarter than us.
I think Kabbalah specifically is the one that, like, when I am studying Kabbalah, I hit stuff like so many times, like just like old ass material. And it's like, I feel like they're trying to explain, you know, new physics to me or something. Yeah. Like it feels like somebody's like trying, like a stone dude is trying to like relate quantum physics to me or something. I'm like, how do they know that? How are they figuring this
out? So and that's because I asked that when we were in this class about Kabbalah. I said, because when they were talking about,
Adam Kadmon?
Yeah. Kadmon, right? Mm. And Einsof.
Yeah.
I was really shocked to see that the description of being out of body and in spirit form was exactly what I experienced when I was deceased, right?
Yeah.
All of it. And it was really unnerving. Like it hit me really hard. And I was like, oh, because it was the first time I had seen in black and white from a very long time ago, right? Yeah. That I had no connection with, no previous exposure to, you know, that all of the things that I experienced from being able to expand or contract, like being little pinpoints of light, like all of those things, having a boundary but no boundary, like all of those things, traveling at the speed of thought, all of them are written in there. All of them are in there. And I was just like, what? Like that was mind-blowing to me. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Like that's just, it's really nuts. And I asked, how the hell did they know this stuff? Like, this is accurate. Like, I know from my experience, like, for me, this is an accurate depiction of exactly what happens. And I'm like, were they getting original knowledge? Like, were these people getting original knowledge? You know, and my professor were like, not even hesitating, was like, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, well, I thought he was going to think about it or something.
Yeah.
He's like, absolutely. And I'm like, well, what happened? He's like, what do you think happened?
Yeah.
We abused it. Like people were getting direct information, and then we decided to do dumb things with that information instead of the things that it was intended for, and then it got pulled back, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's I feel like that's probably accurate. Like I feel like because there's things that based on our understanding now, they knew about ahead of before we did.
Yeah.
Like it's like we're rediscovering things that have already been discovered over and over again. Like history repeating. I don't know. It's very strange to me. But you know, a lot of scholars that don't practice magic, I'd say, most likely anyways, will say that there's, or allude to the fact that there's a hidden information within this text, right? Like,
yes.
That has to do with, like you said, you already said numerology, alchemy, cosmology, right?
Yeah.
Agree or disagree?
Yes. Yeah, I think that if you read the Sefer Yetzirah without commentary or whatever, what is hidden from you is that it is literally... So everybody likes to talk about the background code or of the Matrix, right? Oh, we're in a Matrix. We're in a simulation.
Everybody likes to talk about...
You know, a lot of people do that. Like, simulation theory is really popular right now, right? So the thing is, the Sefer Yetzirah,
it's
like,
facts.
if you read it without the commentary or anything, you may get a little bit of allusion to that, but it's not going to outright say it. But if you spend time meditating and performing the Sefer Yetzirah, what it is revealing to you is each one of those objects in the line of code, right? It is like literally accessing that background code that everybody talks about. And that's why it's like, I think the simulation theory thing that's like, you know, it's really popular with like Reddit people and that kind of stuff. Like, we live in a video game or that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, we've proven it.
Yeah. But I mean, to me, that's not a new take. You know, like, it's like the Kabbalists have been talking about this.
That's what I'm talking about. Like, how the hell they know that?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, there was no computers back then, or maybe there were. Who knows?
But exactly. The thing is, they're saying it, but because there's no computers,
there's
not
no language
it
for it. You're right.
A computer simulation, you know?
Right. Because there's no language, like our language, like our terms now, right? Okay, and then you just alluded to my next question, actually. You just touched on it, which is if if somebody studied this book, right, without any additional supporting texts or anything, like without anything from the rest of Kabbalah at all, do you think that they would understand it fully?
No. But it's an esoteric piece of literature, and it's a performative esoteric piece of literature. It's not just a cosmology. It's not just telling you how things work. It's meant to be worked with.
Okay.
Right. So, and it's encouraging you to work with it. It's telling you there are lines within it that are like, you know, place a crown upon this letter's head, or place it on the tongue, or engrave it with your breath. Like, it's telling you to do it.
Okay. So if you had to compare this to like a scientific document, right? Yeah. Would you say it's like a manual, a blueprint, a code, an experiment? What would it be?
I think manual and blueprint are probably the best ones.
That are supposed to lead to you experimenting?
Yeah. So so if like you wanted to go through the Sefer Yetzirah, you could write down all the correspondences and build like a little matrix. 3D matrix or whatever. You could create an image off of what you read, but it's also explaining to you how to use those things, right? Like a blueprint.
Yeah.
So
I mean, so it is funny though, because it's like you're talking about how the vibrations of letters, right, and sounds are the basis of creation, right? Which is very, you know, sounds a lot like modern day quantum physics, right? Where we're talking about vibrations, everything's vibrations, everything's some form of frequency, vibration, right? So these are not, are they parallel or are they the same? They're just talking the same thing with just the new language. Like we're talking.
I don't know enough about quantum physics. I do know that it is popular for people in the new age or new physics in order to conflate the two.
Right.
So I'm not going to outright say it, but I like, and once again, going to state, it's like Kabbalah is one of the only strains of mysticism, esotericism, magic that I've ran into that like is kind of slapping you with physics. Like, you know, there's an essence in there that's like kind of like this feels a lot like physics, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we did so with the double slit experiment, right? What did we learn from that? We learned that things don't react until there's a conscious observer watching, right? Which is crazy. That means that everything we look at is rendered once we look at it, right? I mean, that's what it means. That's what they say it means. That's the new findings, right? So I don't know if it's a video game necessarily. I think that's us putting our own spin on it because we have video games now. But it is some kind of form of, we're creating our world every day, right? Aren't we? When we participate in it. Mm-hmm. So does this text have anything in it that supports that theory that we're all part of a shared hallucination, basically?
Well, it's great. Yeah. I mean, it's explaining how creation works, and then it's granting you license to, like you said, participate in it, to co-participate in it. Okay. And I think that's why the Sefer Yetzirah and, you know, these kind of Kabbalistic texts are supposed to be hidden and not given over to just anybody, or not given over to Gentiles, because it is a book that is granting you license, like, hey, like, co-participate with God. You know, like,
right, like yourself,
emulate what God does, you know?
Yeah. When we do that by having children, right? That's a normal thing. We create life that way. But this is talking about your all entire reality, right? Like all of the things.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's telling you how to, like, the Sefer Yetzirah is giving you applications to create wealth or, you know, like do magic, basically, you know, like
it's magic,
like
not
love
magic.
And that, like, it's like, if you go into the Bahir or the Zohar, it's not going to tell you like, hey, this letter works with this planet and this body part and it controls wealth and poverty. Use that.
Yeah.
You know,
oh, okay.
It's not,
so they
like,
watered
no,
it down.
No.
So they dialed that back. Did they dial it back then? That's what this is like. Here's all the stuff. And then the next text are like, no. This is only for us.
Yeah, well, the other ones are more concerned with the cosmology, right?
Okay. Yeah. Are there any other ancient books you think pair really well with this one?
The Sefer Yetzirah?
For somebody that wants a deeper understanding or deeper study.
Genesis. Really? Yeah, I mean, that one, Genesis is a banger. That's like the best book.
Pretty dramatic. Pretty, it's like putting it all out there. Just yeah, bam.
I don't know about ancient texts, none that I've ran into, but like I said, I think if you want to look at it through the Sefer Yetzirah, reading it in contrast with the Greek Kabbalah by Kieran Berry is really cool insight to have, a really good perspective to have, because it takes you out of, oh, this has to be the Hebrew alphabet, and it's like getting into the numerology behind it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the numeric factor, the behind the Hebrew, like what makes a magical alphabet, right? There's going to be numbers tied to underneath it. There's going to be pictures and numbers tied underneath it. I specifically, my magical alphabet is the Hebrew alphabet.
Right.
And it's a great magical alphabet to have because they're, you know, Jews love to write about shit. Like they've got a million books.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like, I'm never at a loss to look for insight into utilizing my magical alphabet. If you were to use the Greek alphabet or Sanskrit as your magical alphabet,
limited.
It might be a little more limited, but not as limited with the Greek. There's still a ton of literature on the Greek, but and Sanskrit. It's an alphanumeric one. You know, Arabic works because it's alphanumeric, but like, let's say you're trying to use the Latin alphabet, that one doesn't have the same pictographic or numeric associations behind it, and so it gets a little more difficult, right? There's English? Not as much esoteric information you can extract out of it.
And English, no?
Yeah, the Latin alphabet.
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
So people can't just use it. Like, it's not going to do the
you
same stuff.
You can if you want. I mean, like, you know, on my magic circles, I use the Latin alphabet, right? Yeah. But, you know.
Latin seems to be prevalent in a lot of religious
And your Eurocentric magic, they use the Latin alphabet, but it's missing that factor of pictography, of the numeric associations, and by that it's losing its geometry, its relation to,
but it still works for exorcism.
Those are like invocations and prayers and that kind
not
of stuff.
Creating.
That's a different thing.
That's like if you're that's invocations, prayers, you're not creating, you're calling.
A relationship between and a spirit or a deity, right?
Got it.
Whereas like with Kabbalah, you're like literally engraving something.
Okay, you know? So totally, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Thanks for that, you know, kind of
You're plugging in the code, the background code, right?
Yeah.
You're typing, you're hacking the mainframe.
And I'm telling you, the background code does look very Hebrew.
Yeah.
It does. It's not, but it's close.
Like, well, I believe that.
It does.
The Hebrew
look
alphabet
like it.
Is God's alphabet, but
it's literally because that code. I see it sometimes, and it does look like.
Well, it's interesting because like Paleo Hebrew, which is like Proto
Hebrew,
Proto Phoenician, like before Phoenician, which turned into Hebrew and Aramaic and the Arabic alphabet or whatever. It was the earliest forms of it they find in quarries in Egypt, and it was people using shorthand hieroglyphs.
Yes.
So that's why there's a pictographic association with the Semitic alphabets.
Weird, because it looks like a combination of Hebrew and some kind of hieroglyphics, but they're not familiar. They're very familiar, but not quite. Like, it's just right off. But they're so, it's like, I almost recognize it, but not quite, you know? It's weird.
Well, yeah. And so it's like, if you're trying to approach like primordial, the ancient primordial magic of the Egyptians, the master of magic or whatever, you know, I think Hebrew is the closest you're going to get to that, you know, because it's thought that the Semitic alphabets, which were the first alphabets, were descended from the Egyptian hieroglyphics, and the Egyptians held an incredible belief in the power of language as magic, right?
Okay, so Egyptians, though, like, so hieroglyphs are not an alphabet. It's a picture. It's a picture language, right? Like, what that is. And so the Hebrew is the first actual letter alphabet?
Phoenician is the first developed alphabet, but the predecessor to that, when people first started associating shapes with phonetic sounds.
Okay.
In putting together the phonetic sounds, so that way you didn't have to know thousands of pictures
or
pictographs, hieroglyphs. You only had to know enough to cover the sounds. That was a shorthand, watered down version of hieroglyphs. So it was like really simple recreations of certain hieroglyphs that they were attributing to a phonetic sound. And then that evolved into Phoenician, which then evolved into Paleo-Hebrew and Aramaic.
Where the hell did you learn this stuff? Just curious about language.
What do you mean?
Like, where did you learn all that?
This book is such a large part of my spiritual practice.
You know what I mean? Like, that, so I know,
years
but like,
and years of reading and studying, I couldn't point to a single one thing. Yeah.
Yeah. This is why it pays off to be well rounded in your study.
Yeah.
Because I know nothing about this stuff. Like,
yeah.
I
think
language origins.
Definitely,
and such.
If you're looking at, you know, when you look at the greatest magicians and mystics, prophets, they're all engaging in like letterism, alphanumericism, just some advanced ass magic. Like,
yeah.
Advanced as fuck.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, that's what I mean. So for the people that say, I don't read,
it's really important, I think, for a magician's growth to start engaging in it at some point and growing in it, because that is like, that's the difference between doing somebody else's spell or somebody else's system and literally like manipulating and creating the world around you based off of
your own
creative
ability.
Idea.
Yeah. So that is right. That is the difference. I think also, I think that the those frameworks that are already in place for people to do magic is fairly easy to follow for the most part.
Yeah.
Maybe there might be some ingredients that are difficult to come by or you need to decode, but that's also knowing these things is good to decode that.
Yeah.
Right. But, you're still doing someone else's work.
Mm-hmm.
And then this affords you the ability to do your own work, which obviously is going to be more powerful.
But your creativity is your limit once you develop like a practice that is like as foundational as that. Right.
Yeah. But how do you get there? As you read about the previously set ways of doing
it. I'd say find a magical alphabet and start working with it. And if you read, like, if you're not going to do Hebrew, like, just go through the Sefer Yetzirah anyways, just to see how they're using it and how it's functioning there.
Right.
Read that Kieran Berry book to see how, like, oh, like, this is similar. These are why these things. And then, like, whatever your magical alphabet is, like, start developing a Kabbalistic practice with it, permuting it, visualizing it, understanding the essence of each one, each letter, and each letter as, like, a molecule that you're piecing together. And you're going to get these, like, strings of, like, VFDXHG,
like
it's like this is completely it looks like complete nonsense, but it's like if you know how to permute that and work with it, now all of a sudden you have your very own abracadabra, this is the word that I say when I want this to happen,
right? That's exactly it. It's very helpful if you're trying to actually get real stuff done or have that kind of white light experience is going to come more likely from something you do yourself that you've created, right?
Mm-hmm.
Than something you're copying from somebody else.
Yeah. So you can use it for magical purposes. And then, like you say, the white light experience or whatever, the prophetic Kabbalah is using the same thing, but using it to change between states of consciousness, right? So for example, the Mem Shin permutation, you're switching between Bina consciousness, which is your consciousness that you exist in right now, and Chokmah consciousness, which is your more elevated receptive wisdom consciousness. You're rapidly, when you're permuting it, you're rapidly switching in between those states of consciousness. So you can think about it like putting on 3D glasses. One's red, one's blue, and all of a sudden there's dimension to it, and you create a prophetic experience or a vision through doing this rapid permutation, switching between those states of consciousness.
Is that also considered like alchemy, like letter alchemy, like when you're being able to switch it from one to the other? Is that something that would be, that's what my research said.
Yeah.
That's why I asked.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, and that's where they say the alchemy would be, is to be able to create something like out of a different thing. So
yeah, taking like something, transmute stuff. Or,
yes. Yeah. So, if it had, if this text has one secret message hidden in it, something most readers miss or don't have eyes for yet, or something, I guess, maybe. Mm. What do you think it would be?
I would say meditate on why there is a book teaching you how God created the universe.
Yeah.
Try to figure that one out.
And we don't know who wrote it. No idea. There's a lore, right? But we don't know. It's just there.
Why would this information be here?
Right. Where did it come from? Doesn't matter, right?
I'd say, yeah. Where it comes from doesn't matter. No. What matters is why you have access to it.
Mm. Well, I mean, some people, I'm not naming names here, but some people would be like, where are you getting your information from?
Am I getting my information from?
This book.
From visions.
From this book. I mean, I'm saying
dreams.
People would be like, we don't know its origins.
Unverified personal notes.
So we don't know its origins. It could be a trick. You know what I'm saying? Like how people are, like how I get crap from people about, you don't even know where your information come from.
Yeah.
Right. What do you say to people that say that about this text? Because there's no
author. Like, okay, so like, you know, you don't know who installed that light switch. Don't use it. It's like, well, I mean, it's like, how do you even know it works? It's like, well, if I flick it, the light comes on. No, yeah, but you don't know who installed it.
Could be faulty wiring.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. It's like, well, I'm.
It's working for now.
Turn the lights on. Yeah. Sorry.
Right. So, because I do know that. I do recall a lecture once where the rabbi told us, like, we don't know where it comes from. So a lot of people, like a lot of Jews, will not want to deal with it because they don't know where it came from.
Oh, yeah.
So that's interesting to me, since it's attributed
to
them.
Yeah, so Judaism is very heavily focused on lineages. And that's one of the fascinating things, because they've been scribes for millennia, right? So they write down, and I mean, there's entire books in the Old Testament where it's like literally the entire book is just listing a family lineage, right? And so the thing happens in the rabbinic tradition. So the rabbinic tradition happened after the Second Temple was destroyed.
Right.
That's when it started. Is the rabbinic tradition was an evolution of the Pharisees.
Right.
Right. And the rabbinic tradition, basically, they write down like this rabbi trained under this rabbi, learned from this rabbi, learned from this rabbi. And it goes all the way back to the beginning. Right. You could see that lineage right there. Right.
Yeah.
So when you have something that emerges within Judaism where you can't trace that lineage, it looks highly suspect, because Judaism, archaeologists use the Jewish writing in order to date like Egypt.
Right. Yeah. Like, yeah. Yeah. Right. So that's what I mean. Like, so some people might be like, I don't want to mess with that because we don't know where it came from.
Yeah, exactly. It's very sus. It's very weird when something emerges in Judaism that cannot be traced through a lineage. Right.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. Yeah. That makes sense. Do you personally think that there is still some mystery in this book left for you to discover?
Always.
Yeah.
I never stop. Lucky. I've been working with this book for nearly 10 years, and right now the initiation that I'm in is having me once again retouch it, work through it line by line, one line every single week, and it's unlocking so much.
Right.
It's crazy. It blows my mind.
Yeah. That's when, you know, I think that's a good sign, a good indicator of a true, like, meaningful text, is when you're able to cycle back through it again, depending on the circumstances, and get additional insight from it.
Yeah, that is true esoteric literature. That is true divinely inspired literature, right? It's different from, like, you know, I got it up here, your Science of Breath by Yogi Ramachakara or whatever, where it's like you read it once and then it's just plain as day, like telling you like this. And every time you read it, you're just going to get the same information out of it. That's not divinely inspired. And that's not esoteric literature. It might say it's esoteric literature. It might say these are the secrets of the East, like that kind of shit. It's like, but like, I get the same thing out of this book every single time I read it.
Right.
You know? Whereas like this one, it's like depending on where I'm at, I get redirected back to it and I learn a whole new set of magical skills.
Right. That is like, that's definitely the hallmark of Divinely Inspired, because it's going to resonate with you differently depending on your experience to that date, right? Mm-hmm. So you could read it 10 years ago and get a whole bunch of wonderful things from it.
Yeah.
But you go back a year later after some additional experience in your life, and now the thing you read last year has a different meaning to it than it did. It's still meaningful. It was meaningful the last time, and now it's meaningful in a different way, right?
Yeah.
You know, where you can apply it in a different way. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's like tarot. It's like that too, right? Where when we know that there is no genesis of tarot, actually, that there is nobody created it, like individually, it's just the people adding on. And it applies to every single thing, like somehow. And it's just, that's definitely one of those things. That's why it's so popular. So if you had, how would you advise? So say you have a student come to you that has no concept of any of this, doesn't know what Kabbalah is, never heard of it. Would this be something that you'd have them start with, or how do you? Yes. Yeah, you'd start there.
I think the Sefer Yetzirah is where everybody should start their exploration in Kabbalah, because it's short, it's digestible, it's not.
Not just Kabbalah though, like just mysticism
in general. Yeah, it's one of my essential starter tomes for people. Yeah.
What do you think, if they started that first, it would be easier for them to understand all of the additional non-Jewish traditional texts? Like,
I think it opens you up to alphanumericism, which is like, alphanumericism is very high level magical skill. That's all it influences all the low levels or let's say low levels of magic. That's a ridiculous thing to say. I guess, like, the thing is, like, people use sigils all the time.
Right.
Sigils for spirits.
Sure.
It, to them, it's just, these are the lines that I draw that makes the spirit show up.
Right.
Right? They don't understand why that works. Right?
Yeah, no. Yeah.
So, and the reason why that works is because that sigil is tracing a grid of letters that is the spirit's name, and behind those letters are numbers that are packed into it, and those numbers are representing vertices on a spatial matrix, you know? And so it's like, if you have an understanding of how letterism works, or Kabbalah works, or that kind of stuff, no longer are you limited to, like, you're understanding what spirit you're accessing, but you're not just limited to accessing that spirit. Going to access spirits that nobody's ever written before, you know?
Right? Yeah. So when you make a sigil, okay, so like, if you don't know how to do sigils, like, you can go Google it, right? And it'll always come up with the same thing.
Yeah.
It's like, it gives you this wheel where there's letters and numbers, and it goes up to 9.
Yeah.
Right. And you're supposed to, like, get rid of the vowels, right? Only leave the consonants.
Yeah, that's a chaos magic.
That's just everyone's, like, that's across all the sites I've ever looked at, they're all the same. So that's not from this. That's not, that wheel situation is not coming from this information.
No, I think that's Peter Carroll's method of sigil magic.
Yeah.
That's sigil magic with a K. And that's the chaos magic, sigil magic.
Can we talk about that for a second though? Because the magic with the K at the end of it. Okay. I was told that it started with Crowley. Right. But I did find reference to magic with a K way before him. So what is that about?
Well, it's an archaic spelling of magic. But the only reason it's archaic is because there is no such thing as a dictionary. So it's like, if you were writing a book, and let's say in England in the Elizabethan era or something like that, you might spell magic with a CK, with a C, with a K. You know, there was no standard spelling. You're just sounding it out, right?
Okay. So it's phonetically spelled.
Yeah. So it's like, sure, there's some literature back then that has magic with the CK, but there's literature back then that has magic with C. Crowley did it to distinguish what he did from But Crowley made it popular because he was trying to distinguish what he did from illusionists.
Right. So, and that started, I don't even know when, honestly, the magic without the K, just, and meaning it being parlor tricks, right? Like of illusions.
Yeah.
Right. So that, I guess that is a problem because it's still to this day, when you say magic, everyone asks you that.
Yeah. But I mean, like, how is that a problem?
No. Right? Like, I mean, to distinguish between the two.
To distinguish, what's the context, you know?
Right. I mean,
am I talking to like a stage entertainer? Then I'm going to assume he's talking about illusions. Am I talking to somebody that's wearing talismans? I'm going to assume they're talking about
magic.
Yeah.
Yeah. And and then the illusion practice is just trying to kind of do what actual magic does, but without doing those things.
It was, there is kind of in the 19th and 20th century, when illusionists were popular, there was a crossover between occultists and illusionists. But I mean, I personally think it's entirely impractical. Like, what's the point of distinguishing between, you know, like what I'm talking about and like who am I trying to distinguish it to? If I'm talking about magic and somebody thinks I'm an illusionist, I don't need to correct them on that.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's when you're looking for texts, you know.
When you're looking for text, but then what texts are you getting access to? Because that's another reason that I don't distinguish, like in my personal writing, I don't use magic with a K. Because if somebody's looking for magic with a K, they're looking for 20th century books on magic.
Right.
If I'm, like, somebody's looking for magic with a C, they're usually looking for academic work, or they're looking for something that's from the classical period
let me correct that. Like, I'm gonna say that's not accurate because I did not know that there was a difference between the two, right? Like, when I was looking for texts, like way back when I was younger, I literally thought that magic with the C meant illusionist. Yeah. That's all I knew. Like, I did not have any concept that was actually what I was like witchcraft magic, like actual magic. So as a kid, like 12 years old, someone told me about the CK meant that this is magic, like you perform magic in the spiritual context, and then magic with just a C is illusion, card tricks, etc. I grew up my entire adult life thinking that until very recently.
Yeah.
So I think that that's not uncommon either.
It's not uncommon. I mean, you can definitely tell what currents, like you can tell, like old heads within the occult and magical community do magic with the CK, like people that are from the 70s, 80s, 90s, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Because it was more prevalent then.
Like, yeah.
The two practices were like illusionists. There were.
That's just, I mean, those people were practicing what? They were practicing Wicca. They were practicing OTO. They were practicing Golden Dawn. And that's how that's how those currents spell it, right? So you can place somebody. Like, you can see what kind of magic they practice or when they got into the occult based off of how they spell that word, right? But, like, let's say I'm on academic EDU and I'm looking at papers about magic, like, history of magic or that kind of stuff. None of those guys use a CK.
No, they don't.
They use a C. Let's say I'm reading, classical grimoires, Renaissance grimoires. They're not using magic with a CK.
They're not using C. Yeah, they are. But for people that are looking for texts that are like newer, you know, they're likely going to be thinking that anything with a C is going to be just talking about
when you go into your occult bookstore.
Right.
Those are all going to be magic with the CK, right?
I guess.
But then most of them. And then there's...
Or ceremonial magic with a C.
Yeah.
Because ceremonial's in front of it, right? Yeah. So that's... I mean, I think the spelling of it can confuse some people sometimes. Like,
Sometimes. I mean, like, I know what it is. I mean, personally, if I see a book spelled with CK, I know there's nothing in it for me.
Really? You know?
Yeah.
I mean,
I won't read it.
Yeah, I guess
it's not going to have anything that's a part of what is relevant to my practice.
Well, I think, okay, so like to that point, like a lot of my early books that I purchased were definitely with a CK.
Yeah.
Now all of them are not. So it's just as you, I think, go through it and
I think
realize
the pendulum swung too, whereas like Wicca used to be like a very serious brand of magic. Like, that was very, like, real head shit, you know? And then the pendulum swung, and now it's kind of, like, goofy. Campy. That's cute. Like, oh, you practice, that's cute. That kind of stuff. And so it's, like, when you see, like, old heads that used to be in the occult community, magic with the CK meant that you were really fucking serious about this shit. Whereas, like, now, people associate the magic with the CK with, like, witch talk and that kind of thing. You
yes,
know?
True.
So the pendulum's kind of swung to, you know.
And it has.
Yeah.
It has. It has. It has. I know. It has. It's like now it's associated with kind of campy, cheesy.
Yeah.
Fad magic stuff. Like fad trendy.
Yeah.
It's trendy.
Yeah. I mean, it's been really recent that that's happened, you know.
Which is why, very recent.
If you're, like, in occult communities or whatever, you'll see, like, very serious, like, high level magicians who are older, you know, in their 50s or 60s, they'll be using the magic with the CK at the same time as, like, the, you know, Tumblr witch that's cursing the president of the United States
or the moon.
Know?
Yeah. Those idiots. Yeah. Well, I mean, so if there's, it does create different, it does create, like, a different, like, category, though. It does, like, it's CK now kind of is the watered down version, right? Whereas before it was more serious.
Well, it's the 20th century version for sure.
Yeah.
And so it's like, if you're practicing magic from the 20th century, like, the magic with the CK is where you're going to find that, you know?
But, yeah.
Like, what I practice is more in primary sources and, like, if I'm looking for magic with the C, I'm looking for Greco-Roman Egyptian spells with magic for a CK, I'm going to be sorely disappointed by the material I turn out.
You won't find anything. That's the thing. And then also, some of them are just not even titled magic at all.
Yeah.
You know, and that language helps, you know, to look for. But so you had mentioned earlier in one of the first questions that I asked you about how you use the Hebrew alphabet, and then, but you also use Islamic kind of magic too, right? Or Arabic magic, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so those two things don't typically go together, right?
Like, yeah, so the numerologic associations don't match, right? So you see that perfect breakdown that you have of 22 letters into 3, 7, and 12?
Yeah.
Can't do that with the Arabic alphabet. But what you can do with the Arabic alphabet is, because it's 28, you can divide the sky up into lunar phases with the Arabic alphabet, right? Yeah. So what alphabet am I using for what? And it's like hard because you really want to marry everything into a nice little package, but, you know, sometimes you just can't do that.
But it seems to still work for you, right? Like,
My magic is highly syncretic, right? Like, I do Arabic magic. I have ceremonial techniques. And when I'm meditating, I'm doing Kabbalah, right?
Yeah.
It's like...
Yeah. So there's, like, this bringing together... You've managed to bring together different traditions to make your own unique system, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think that was the intention.
Yeah, it was. It was absolutely your subconscious intention. No, leading you down the path you're supposed to be on.
Yeah.
I didn't tell you that much. I saw that for you. But I just have a question, because now we have, like, I mean, that's the thing that's been missing this whole time, is, like, to kind of integrate all of it together, right? You know, all of the different bits of wisdom from different cultures and groups of people that existed around the same times.
Yeah.
Where they were getting this seemingly, like, original information or, like, primary information that they were then writing into primary text, right? So, you know, this is, to understand this stuff, like, this is a good basis to begin, right? This is, and it'll help you to dissect and to understand any additional. But, like, if you're a magical practitioner that needs to understand the why behind things or the genesis of things, it's here you start. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, like, this is going to be probably the oldest book on Kabbalah that you're going to find. It's, you know, it might read like Genesis, but it's pretty easy to read. know, you're not going to be like the Bahir. If you read the Bahir, you're probably going to get lost.
So that is a book that we did have excerpts from, and it was more complicated for me.
Understand. You're probably going to get lost reading the Bahir. Right. Whereas the Sefer Yetzirah, like, you're not going to get lost. It's going to read like Genesis.
Okay. Yeah. But why is Kabbalah important for a person that is into the occult or the, you know, magic practice? To know about.
Well, it's at the core of how we understand. It is so highly influential on Western magic. But there's different sources. You have the magicians who have their own Kabbalah that they kind of like confused around the Jewish Kabbalah. And then, but you could go to the Jews and ask them and learn from them. They're the masters of it. So why not? But there's a Kabbalah to, you know, there's a Kabbalah to language, and it doesn't matter what language you're using. So I would say, you know, you're utilizing the best sources possible. If I want to learn how to make talismans, I go learn from the Arabs. I'm not going to learn from the Jews. Right. If I want to learn Kabbalah, I go learn from the Jews.
What does
I don't
Kabbalah
learn from
mean?
The magicians. It's like it's revealed, right? Okay. Yeah.
Right. So yeah, if you want to have that understanding of that fundamental aspect of most magic practice, then I guess that would be a good place to start.
Yeah.
And you don't have to be Jewish to read it, you know?
No.
And it's in English. You can get English translations of it, right?
That was one of the things, like, Gentiles will always tell you that you can't, it will give you a million reasons not to study Kabbalah or do Kabbalah, and they'll come up with all these ideas about, like, oh, like, you know, you have to be Jewish and you have to be 40 and you have to be a man. And like, that's when I first started learning Kabbalah, ended up meeting, my parents were friends with this Jewish guy. Yeah. And, you know, we were talking one day and, he realized I was into Kabbalah, and he invited me to come and sit in at his Kabbalah study group at his Reform temple. And I got to sit with like actual Jewish men that were studying Kabbalah. They didn't have a problem with me learning it. They knew I wasn't Jewish. They weren't trying to convert me.
Yeah. Right?
It's actually really hard to convert to Judaism. Even Reform.
And my mom did.
I tried to for a little bit, and I couldn't get anybody to take me seriously.
Really?
But wow. Yeah. But I was in like a weird place. I was doing it like in a panic mode.
Oh,
you know?
I
wasn't doing it.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
But but yeah, no, it's like usually Jewish people are really excited. I mean, unless you're talking about like Hasids or something like that, like ultra Orthodox. Usually Jewish people are really excited to talk about the religion and talk about what they know about the Kabbalah.
Yeah.
And, you know, share with you. You know what they can, so you can learn from Jews, and there's plenty of literature. The thing is, like Moses Cordovero, he was a medieval Kabbalist, and he was the first Kabbalist that was like, all right, now it's time to open this up to the Gentiles, right?
Yeah.
And so he wrote this book called Introduction to Kabbalah, and he was 22.
Wait, that book's that old?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he was 22 when he decided. So he was already master of Kabbalah at 22, and he decided it's like time to open it up to every Jew and the Gentiles. And this was during the Middle Ages. So it's like this whole myth of you can't study Kabbalah if you're not Jewish, you're a woman and you're under 40. It's like maybe like amongst Hasids, you know, but, you know, there's plenty of rabbis and Jews out there that are like, no, like this is for everybody. We can't, because the goal of the Kabbalist, like if you are a Kabbalist as a religious thing, the goal of the Kabbalist is to awaken the divine spark in everything and everyone, kind of like Buddhism, right? And bring it back to God.
Right.
And so there are Kabbalists out there like, we need to open up the Kabbalah so everybody can go back to God.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So that's interesting. And I when you said 40, that struck me, because in a lot of Dion Fortune's books, it says the thing about 40 also is when you hit
certain
things.
To,
we're good. Well, that was, so my last question was just, you know, is there anything else that you'd like to share with the listeners about the importance of this text or your personal gnosis from it?
Yeah, I'd say jump into it. It's practical. Do it. You've been listening to Discourse, where we venture into the mysteries of esotericism, the occult, and the depths of spiritual exploration. I am Abimon the Great, joined as always by Dr. Anna Stone, bringing adept insights to help guide your journey. Remember, the path of wisdom is illuminated by both knowledge and experience. Until next time, continue your exploration and stay attuned to the unseen.